Gracious greetings and warm welcome to the Animal Voices show, broadcasting live from 102.7 FM CFRO in beautiful Vancouver, Canada, on unceded Coast Salish territory. Today is Friday, May 18th, 2012. I will be your host today. My name is Alyssa Ray. I'm joined in studio today by a few lovely and compassionate beings, Allison Cole on the controls, and
hello.
Tim Aretz is going to be doing the news today, and he's helping out with the controls. Thanks for coming. And we also have in studio with us Krista Truman. She's a former Animal Voices host. Thanks for coming back and joining us today, Krista.
Very happy to be here.
Animal Voices is Western Canada's only program dedicated solely to animal advocacy and compassionate living, bringing you all the events, headlines, interviews, and reviews you need to stay up to date with what's happening around Metro Vancouver and beyond. We at Animal Voices are committed to bringing a voice to the voiceless, to shedding light on the injustice so prevalent in the way in which humankind views and treats non-human animals. We believe in a world in which non-human animals are afforded the right to live free of exploitation. On today's show, we are featuring a couple interviews. The first will be with Jane Schneider. She's a local woman who was involved with some recent rescues of battery-caged hens, and we look forward to speaking with her at about quarter after. And later in the show, for our feature interview, we are going to be talking about educating our children about compassionate choices. And we have as our special guest Ruby Roth. She's a writer and illustrator, an artist. She has created two books for children, her older one called That's Why We Don't Eat Animals, and her latest book, Vegan is Love, which is stirring up quite a controversy and has received quite a bit of media attention about it perhaps being too graphic or, you know, just too big of a message for little ones. So we're going to talk to Ruby about that and Krista as well. First off, Allison's going to share some upcoming events with us.
Yep, these are this week's upcoming events. On Saturday, May the 19th to Monday, May the 21st, from 1 o'clock to 3 p.m., there will be a protest at the Cloverdale Rodeo, which is happening at 176 and 64th Streets in Surrey. That's the entrance of the Cloverdale Rodeo. The protest, so this is a protest against rodeo cruelty. Signs and leaflets will be provided, but feel free to bring your own. A group of activists will be in front of the fairgrounds at the corner of 176 and 64th Streets. And if you need a ride to the protest, call Jason at 604-809-4041 to arrange a ride. They'll be picking up people at 12 p.m. from the King George SkyTrain station. So once again, that's happening the 3 days of the rodeo. That's this week, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday from 1 o'clock to 3 p.m.
Yeah, I don't know what the...
On Sunday, May the 20th at 12 p.m., Vancouver Meatless Meetup is hosting a parents and kids vegetarian lunch, which is happening at Greens and Gourmet Restaurant at 2582 West Broadway in Vancouver. In the theme of raising children as vegans and vegetarians on today's show, if you're a parent listening to the show today, you may be interested in this event. As of yesterday or 2 days ago, there were 23 parents and kids signed up to attend, so there will be lots of people there to meet and congregate with. Greens and Gourmet is a pay-by-weight buffet-style veggie restaurant, and there will be 20% a 20% off discount for the special event. And this is open to those people without children looking for personal advice and experience on fertility, pregnancy, raising vegan and vegetarian children, natural birth, breastfeeding, single parents, or those who just love being around children or who are kids at heart themselves. All are welcome to attend. If you would like to attend, please go to www.meetup.com and search for Vancouver Meatless Meetup, where you can then RSVP for this event. On Tuesday, May the 29th, from 6 till 9 p.m., Liberation BC is having their monthly volunteer night for May. This is happening at Nice Shoes, the Nice Shoes Vegan Shoe Store at 3568 Fraser Street in Vancouver. Join your fellow activists for an evening of fun, good conversation, and some activism as well. Activities will include making cow ribbons and writing letters to the food companies, Daya and Silk, requesting that they stop using palm oil in their products. And if you want to know why palm oil is bad, please go to animalvoices.org and listen to our show from April the 27th, which features an interview with Dr. Berute Galdikas, who is an expert on the orangutans, and she explains in that interview how the palm oil industry is wiping out the orangutans. And ongoing from now until May the 30th, the Toronto Vegetarian Society is holding a contest called Why I'm Veg. This June, the Toronto Vegetarian Association will launch their first ever Why I'm Veg Week, featuring Why I'm Veg videos from vegetarians and vegans of all shapes and sizes, including the famous, the expert, and the soon-to-be-discovered. They would like you to share your Why I'm Veg video with the world by May 30th. For the chance to win great prizes. Contest details are at veg.ca/video contest, and through these videos you will have the opportunity to inspire thousands of others to consider issues like sustainability, healthy eating, and compassion for animals for the first time. And just as an addition to the first event that I was speaking about the rodeo in Cloverdale, I'm just curious, Alyssa, have you been to one of these protest events before at the Cloverdale Rodeo?
Nope.
Okay. Have you, Krista?
Nope, but I have been to the Cloverdale Rodeo, and it's atrocious.
So I know that they've been doing a lot of, the Vancouver Humane Society had a campaign against the rodeo in Cloverdale years ago where they got, I think it was calf roping banned, right? So, I mean, after many, many horrific accidents and deaths and that, so they're concentrating on targeting the Calgary Stampede now. So I want to do an interview about that in the future. So anyways, just curious as to, there's always animal activists in the Vancouver area that are going out to the Cloverdale Rodeo every year. And that's around your neck of the woods too, right, Krista? Because I certainly never get out there.
Yeah, it's, it's south of the Fraser, so mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's my neck of the woods. I will say that although I've never been myself, I have supplied baked goods for the activists who did go. So,
well, thank you for that. That counts. If you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver.
You're listening to 102.7 FM, of course, still. And I have with me in studio today Krista Truman. And although we don't usually get personal and talk much about our lives, I kind of want to, because I'm curious about your life, Krista, and I look up to you as a longtime vegan and amazing animal advocate, I wondered if you could just like share a little bit about yourself. Can you tell us first how and when you came to the vegan lifestyle and how you heard the plight of animals and heeded that call?
Sure. I'm glad people can't see me blush on the radio. It happened in 1998. I guess my journey really started when I met my husband, who had been a vegetarian since he was about 10 years old. So that was what really got the ball rolling. And in 1998, he was diagnosed with a dairy allergy by his naturopath. And so we decided, although we hadn't had meat in our household for a while, we were going to explore not having dairy in our homes. And that was right around the time we started to have internet access in our home as well. And as soon as I started looking up dairy-free, stuff about the dairy industry started to come up. And it wasn't something that I'd really thought about or explored before. So it was shocking. And then, you know, just naturally from that, the progression was looking at where our eggs came from, looking at where animal products for like stuff around your house or your beauty routine or whatever. And it was almost like natural at that point, because the whole reason we were leaving off eating meat was because we actually cared about animal suffering. So as soon as we saw the suffering involved in all of that other stuff, it became obvious that was the choice we'd have to make. It wasn't without its ups and downs. We had a lot of people very concerned about the health of our son, who was about 18 months old at that time. And he had weaned, so we were, you know, people were very concerned about him getting enough to eat. And but with enough research, and thank goodness for the internet, because that was an amazing source of information for us at that time. So, yeah, that's what really started it.
Amazing. So you have now raised two beautiful vegan children.
I have indeed.
They are, how old are they now?
My son is going to be 15 next month, and my daughter will be 11 in August.
Wow, awesome.
Yeah.
Did you, you said you experienced criticism with raising them vegan, you must have done lots of research on the nutritional requirements for kids and everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you talk a bit about that, about the reaction from others about your kids' health? Or
There was a lot of concern about that. I think the main, and I was concerned too, I'm not going to lie, that was something that I always said if it seemed like my kids weren't thriving, I would of course go back to putting animal products in our diets. Mm-hmm. That never happened. The two things I was mostly concerned about, especially with like a toddler who was no longer nursing, was that he got enough fats, mm-hmm. enough good healthy fats. So we really focused on those, and we used a blend of essential oils like flax and pumpkin and hemp, and we add those into smoothies. He also loved to eat avocados and lots of nut butters and that sort of thing. And of course B12 we were always concerned about, so we made sure we bought lots of fortified foods. And yeah, it wasn't really that challenging. And I mean, it was a lot more challenging than it is now. So mm-hmm. if I did it in 1998, yeah. People can totally do it now. There's like so much more information out there about it, and it's so accessible.
Definitely. And just the last question, since we're going to be talking about this a bit later in the show, just some of the sort of social concerns with like teaching your kids about animal cruelty, or how their friends, parents, or friends kind of react to that kind of thing. Can you just talk a bit about sort of kind of the social aspect?
Sure. I wish I had my kids here, actually. They're very articulate about that.
They were here a couple of years ago, and they were amazing.
Yeah, they have great answers for these questions. I don't think that it's always been easy for them, because it's hard to be different no matter what, whatever it is. So there have definitely been challenges for them. I would say that overall, though, it hasn't been as bad as a lot of people expect it to be. Other kids tend to just kind of take things at face value, especially at the younger ages, and they don't get as weirdly defensive about their eating, people's eating choices, as adults seem to. So while there's been questions, I wouldn't say there's been anything really mean-spirited about any of it. Usually it's just curiosity. If a kid has decided they've taken a dislike to one of my kids, then of course they're going to use that as a way to pick on them. But in general, it's just been curiosity. And my daughter, who's quite outspoken about her veganism, has two kids in her class who have, one has gone vegan and the other has gone vegetarian since speaking with
That's
her.
Fantastic.
So the web spreads, right?
Awesome.
Yeah.
Good. Well, we look forward to hearing more of your thoughts later in the show.
Cool.
For now, we turn to our interview. Now, imagine spending countless hours, endless days, trapped in a dark elevator with six other people. That horrifying image gives a glimpse into the hellish existence of some 26 million birds in Canada, who make over 90% of the nation's egg-laying hens. With us now to shed some light on these dark corners and tell us how she recently rescued some lucky hens from those horrors is Jane Schneider. Thank you for joining us on Animal Voices on your lunch break today, Jane.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's my understanding that you've been involved with two recent hen rescues. Can you tell us first about the rescue in December of last year?
Mm-hmm. I made contact with a farmer who was willing to sell me his battery hens before they went to slaughter. And so in December, well, it took months before that, I had found homes and got some contacts as to where we could get some some good homes for these birds and the finances and all that set. And then in December, yes, we went into a battery hen operation, and the farmer, you know, allowed me to take, really, I could have taken as many as I wanted to. We found homes for 170 at that point, and yeah, so out they went, and into good homes they all went.
Well, so you were contacting different farms, or there's just like one near your house or something? Or
this is such you know what, it was a friend of a friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And had you done actions like that before?
No, I had never done it before, but I know of other provinces, friends in other provinces who do it. And my passion for chickens, just, I couldn't let this opportunity go when I found out the farmer had, you know, approved of selling me these hens. Mm-hmm. So, no, I hadn't been.
Wow, that's amazing. 170, that's awesome. And last month in April, you conducted another hen rescue. Can you tell us a bit about that one?
Yes, that was, well, I think we used up so many of the homes with 170. We had a really hard time finding new homes for this batch. So we found, enough placements for 30 chickens. And so they're all homed now, and I do hope to do this like every 6 months. This is a farmer who has 90,000 birds. They rotate on a 30,000 slaughter about every 6 months. And these birds in particular, these ones were interesting because these were only year-old hens. Usually they would keep these hens in a cage for a year and a half. And there was a reasoning behind that, because it's all about timing and moving the, rotating the birds, and the cleaning of the barns and everything. So they were only a year old. So they were in not too bad condition this time, although their beaks had been cut, debeaked terribly. It was very interesting. It was an interesting rescue because, I'll just quickly tell you, I had said to the farmer the next day, I said, I noticed that these hens even behaved differently. And he said, well, all battery hens that I know of anyway are the Leghorn breed, but what they're doing is now they're taking certain traits from the Leghorns, which will make it easier for them, for the hens, to be caged. So this was a much calmer bird.
Mm.
But yeah, I know. They were a bit calmer, but what was so brutal is that either they didn't lay eggs, or the eggs that they laid had no shells.
Oh.
So it's almost like they get one trait, and then it disrupts the other trait. So I'm not sure where this is all going to go. But
wow,
it's shocking. It's shocking.
You know what? It is. It's shocking how we manipulate the bodies of animals, period.
Well, so you said that those birds were in a little better condition than the ones you rescued in December. Can you tell us about their condition and let us know about some of the details of how hens suffer in these intensive systems?
Yes. Well, let me tell you, we did do a little bit of footage on it, so there is on a YouTube the rescue itself. We found those birds to so many. Well, their feathering is just, they're in terrible condition. They're feathering. A lot of them are missing feathers because, of course, in the small confined areas, chickens tend to peck at one another. And there will always be a dominant bird, and there will always be the lower bird on the, you know, in the pecking order. So they'll come with injuries. They'll come, of course, with their feathers missing because they often will. Like, the urine and the feces doesn't always go through the bar, like the mesh of the cage, so they're often sitting for long periods of time on feces, so they have scalded behinds. We had some chickens who were prolapsed, which means their insides, where they, you know, they, like, the uterus is basically on the outside. Oh, my goodness. Psychological horrors. I mean, they're a prey animal to start with, and they have even more fear just being caged like that. The inability to move, the inability to not do natural behaviors, like they're scratching and the brooding. I mean, they like to sit on their eggs. They are denied everything that they enjoy doing, really, for the sake of the consumer.
I guess the rehabilitation process is taxing. Can you tell us about that? Like, did you give them like vet care, and how did they react to
yeah.
their freedom?
You know, it's so amazing. Once they're in the cages, once we had all these cages out, they don't want to leave the cage because that was their safe place.
Mm-hmm.
But once we got them out, you know, they started flapping their wings, and then they started scratching the ground. It was just within hours, they started acting like chickens. So that was beautiful to see. And then really within, you know, weeks, just a couple weeks, they would go into the dust bath. They just don't lose any of their true, you know, sense of being a chicken. So it doesn't take long to rehab them. We did, of course, have to euthanize some of the birds. A couple of them had broken wings, and a couple had broken wings just from the catch. But also, some had broken wings because the vet said that there was the deposits around the fracture, and they had been sitting in those cages with broken, broken limbs.
Mm-hmm.
They're so skinny. They have no muscle on their breastbone. They're spent, and honestly, when they say the word spent, these chickens are spent.
Right.
And that's why they're only used for dog food and fertilizer.
Wow. And just for people who don't know, can you tell us how long a chicken might normally live outside of the system?
Oh, yeah. 8 to 12 years.
Right.
And they're wonderful.
I've heard that, and you never see chickens live that long because no one ever gives them the chance to.
Oh, yeah. No. And you know, the first chicken, I'll just quickly tell you how wonderful these animals are. The first chicken I rescued, which was just in the field, and, you know, my friend called me a chicken in the field, you know, got her all back to health, and she was living downstairs in our basement, da-da-da. And one day, you know, I was watching TV, and I looked over at the stairs, and I saw my chicken appear. She had walked up the staircase. Mm-hmm. She walked over to the couch, sat on my lap, and we watched TV together. And she did that every night.
Nice.
Like, they're so intelligent and loving, and we deny them all of that.
Yeah. I can definitely relate to that too. I had a couple pet chickens growing up. Same thing. Come inside, sit on your lap, watch TV.
I know.
They'll do that.
Nice.
They love the warmth.
Yeah, I'm really glad you shared that. That's one thing that most people don't understand about chickens, and it is, well, May is International Respect for Chickens Month, as organized by United Poultry Concerns in the States. And I want to, I hope our listeners do something to recognize chickens this month, and maybe if it's, you know, cutting out eggs for a week or just committing to living a totally chicken product-free life, that would be amazing.
Because I don't think most people realize that there is no such bird as a chicken that lays an egg every 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people just think that this is normal, but this is totally not normal, that humans have just genetically modified the wild chicken, like thousands of years mm-hmm. ago, to produce an egg every 24 hours. It's no wonder their bodies are so calcium deficient and why they are getting cancer of the uterus, because it's so unnatural. If birds lay a clutch of eggs once or twice a year and they raise their young.
Mm-hmm.
We've created this bird that produces an egg every 24 hours. Really, it would take 7 days to produce an egg inside a bird.
Speaking of egg producing, Tim Hortons, the leading Canadian fast food chain, has announced they will submit to sourcing 10% of their egg supply from enriched housing systems in 2013. This is part of their new sort of animal welfare platform. Can you tell us how you feel about that, Jane?
Well, enriched cages really not that much. Is that?
Yeah. Like, what are enriched housing systems?
Well, they're going to be adding, and they're going to be adding per. It sounds like this: per two birds, they will be adding the size of a postcard into these cages. Now, there's usually six birds, so just imagine the cage is now a tiny bit bigger with, you know, three postcards, that much more space.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, they will have, I think they will have a perch, they will have a dust bathing area, and apparently a nest box. Honestly, I don't know how they're going to fit that in there, because these birds barely can fit into these cages as is. They stand up, and that's about the space that they have. Anyway, I'm not sure how they're going to fit all this in, but the problem is going to be chickens have a pecking order, and the dominant chicken is going to be fighting off everybody else to get to these types of facilities, you know, that they have in the cage. So I don't really see how it's any better. What I do appreciate is that Tim Hortons has kind of opened up a door, mm-hmm. because when they posted that YouTube about increasing from 1%, and now they've increased their you know, they're saying they're going to buy eggs from 10% of farmers who have enriched cages. I think on that post, a lot of people didn't know that chickens even came from an environment
yeah.
of cages. Like, many of the Facebook comments were, look at all those cages. I didn't know chickens were, you know, chickens laid eggs in cages. So they kind of opened that door. But I'm certainly not supportive of it. I don't want bigger cages. I want them out of cages.
Yep.
And, you know, eventually, let's just stop enslaving animals.
Certainly. That's a good note to end this on. Thank you so much for sharing your views today. If people are interested in learning more about, getting hens out of battery cages, the Vancouver Humane Society organizes a Chicken Out campaign, which has been running for a number of years. Yeah, there's lots of local resources. Liberation BC has an excellent info page about eggs if you want to learn more. Thank you so much for your time today, Jane.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye, Jane.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Tune in Thursday nights for Fruit Salad from 7 to 8 p.m.
Tune in to Fruit Salad.
Tune in Thursday nights for Fruit Salad.
Check out Fruit Salad Thursday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. on 102.7 FM, highlighting queer, trans, lesbi, gay organizations, writers, performers, musicians, families, pink world news, and much, much more. Fresh fruit, every show.
Tune in.
Well, hello, this is the Tim Aretz with the news for today's show. I start off with good news, and the state of California in the United States is finally enforcing a ban on foie gras, which is, is French for fatty liver, and foie gras is a very cruel production of this product, where corn is fed through a tube into geese or ducks to produce this foie gras. And already this ban was decided 8 years ago in California, but now they're finally enforcing it. And they are joining basically a group of already over 30 countries worldwide that have banned foie gras. But in the United States, they are the first state to do so, and there have been protests of local chefs and restaurateurs because they claim that foie gras would actually, they believe that foie gras farming is not harmful or hurtful for the duck, but most other studies show otherwise. The European Union had a scientific committee review done on it, where they analyzed several studies from producing countries, and they came to the conclusion that force feeding is detrimental to the welfare of the bird. So I think this is a step in the right direction to finally outlaw this product.
I think it's pretty funny that they have to do scientific studies to figure out that this is not pleasant for birds. All you have to do is look at a photograph of it happening, and like instinctively you should know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That was a lot of years for the phase-out, like 8 years or something? Are they producing? Are they big producers of foie gras? I don't, like,
I think there's only
the phase-out?
There's only one farm.
There's always a phase-out. That's always years.
Okay.
There's only one farm in California that is still producing foie gras, so I think it doesn't hurt the economy too much. So then in other news, Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Foundation got arrested in Germany on a decade-old charge from Costa Rica, where he got an event with a Costa Rican ship. They were fishing for sharks and cutting off their fins and throwing them back in the water. That happened in Guatemalan water in 2002, and now Costa Rica is trying to get him extradited from Germany, where he got arrested. So right now Sea Shepherds are running a campaign to free him, and if you want to support their cause, you can email the German federal minister Sabine Leutheiser-Schnarrenberger. I'm not going to spell out her name here on the radio.
I'm impressed you can even say that. Then again, you are German.
Yes, I am. Or the foreign minister Guido Westerwelle. And you can find the email addresses, though, on the website of the Sea Shepherd Association, seashepherd.org. And maybe we can also put them up on the website of Animal Voices, animalvoices.org, is it?
That's it.
And, you know, I read yesterday that he's facing the death penalty if he goes to Costa Rica. So that's, like, really serious.
Yeah. So, and then I have a last bit of news, which is I find very interesting. I have it. In Sweden, researchers have found a chimpanzee to be even more, even smarter than they have previously thought. Chimps are already considered to be very, very smart. And they have found that a chimpanzee in a zoo in Furuvik, I'm not sure if I pronounce it correctly, but I assume so, in Sweden, is very foresighted and innovative and able to, I quote the researchers, able to anticipate behaviors of others who are not present in the situation where he makes his preparations. So what he did is he threw stones at visitors of the zoo, which is common behavior for apes. But the wardens of the zoo always warned the visitors to back off when they saw him with rocks in his hands. So he created concealed weapon stashes close to the walls, and then the scientists say, to the guide, his appearance did not suggest intentions in throwing. The chimpanzee even stopped and picked up an apple floating in the water, which he took a bite as he continued approaching the visitors. Just within range, he made a sudden throw at the group. So he was clearly annoyed by these visitors and was able to get at them, even though he was in his confined space.
I just love that he kind of, like, faked the eating the apple thing, and then, wham, there comes
exactly.
The stone.
Like, really thinking ahead.
I saw that on the news yesterday.
Smart chimp. So, this concludes the news for today.
Chop the world, little boys.
song by Cousin Nobody called All Kids Care. Sorry for the sound quality. You can't really understand the words, but it's about, you know, things are really messed up in the world, and all kids seem to have that natural empathy. So that's what we're talking about today, educating children about compassionate choices. And no one can deny that children have a natural affinity towards animals. Children's stories and films are filled with happy, cuddly creatures who talk. But how do we as animal advocates draw back the curtain and show children that their choices can actually harm animals? How do we teach and nurture the minds and hearts of little ones and let them know that the responsibility we have is to nurture animals? And so today, I'm joined in studio by Krista Truman, a former Animal Voices host and parent, as I introduced her before. And we also are very pleased to have Ruby Roth on the phone with us to discuss these issues. Ruby's a trained artist, a writer, an educator, and stepmom, and an author and illustrator of two awesome books for children. One is called That's Why We Don't Eat Animals, and her latest is Vegan is Love, Having Heart and Taking Action. Thanks for joining us today, Ruby, to talk about your books and your experience educating children.
Hi, Ruby.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, you're so very welcome. So first, congratulations on the release of the new book, Vegan is Love. It's bright and gorgeously illustrated, and it really empowers kids to make choices that are not only kind to all animals, but also mindful of health and global issues like climate change and pollution. And you've really covered the whole picture, and we're all really impressed with your work.
Thank you, and as we say in the book trailer, it's so easy even adults can understand. That's a really big basic introduction.
It's a good intro for some adults, for sure.
Yeah. Easy to comprehend.
Yeah, definitely. So can you tell us how you tried to tailor your message to children specifically? What sort of work went into to making sure that this book was appropriate for young minds?
Well, I wanted to include all the major tenets of veganism, from food to health to the environment and pollution and animals. I did not want to sugarcoat or avoid the truth, but I also took great care to make it manageable for a child's capacity. And I read the book during the process to lots of kids and bounced ideas off of my own stepdaughter and just kind of felt out what was appropriate and what kids were interested in and what they understand.
And do you have, I think I read somewhere that you have a history like teaching art to kids or being around kids. Did you sort of test your images on them and get feedback from?
When I was writing my first book, I was teaching art at an elementary school, and that's really how the first book was inspired, because the kids all wanted to know why I wasn't eating the string cheese and drinking the milk that they were served at recess. And as I started talking little bit by little bit about my own views, I was shocked to find just how interested they were in veganism and healthy foods and having an impact on protecting animals and the environment. And so it really went from there.
Awesome. And so there has been quite some media coverage, some widespread, from Fox News and CNN in the States to the Daily Mail in the UK, Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper, as well as our local news TV station, Global News. They all covered your book and many more. Why do you think this book in particular sort of exploded and got so much attention?
Well, I think it touches on the truth. And while kids are very open to hearing about the truth, we adults come into contact with what's happening with animals, and it's hard to look at. It's hard to acknowledge our personal role and responsibility in the abuse and the destruction we inflict on animals and the environment. And I think the controversy that has been stirred by this book has only proven the need for a book like this, where we can really look at our personal habits, the choices we make every day, and how 7 billion of us are affecting the public realm on a daily basis.
And what issues in particular can you tell us that that instances in your book, words or pictures that people specifically had a problem with or thought maybe were too graphic for kids?
The animal testing spread is one that's getting mentioned a lot as being graphic. It's a painting of animals in cages, and they do have some wounds, and they look sad. But what's really interesting is I think that adults forget what it's like to think as a child. When we look at that image, we're reminded of the realities of what goes on inside labs. We know there's exposed organs and syringes and pillories and restraints. So that's very scary to us. When a kid looks at this image, all they see is animals with ouchies. And I think that that's a perfectly appropriate jumping off point for discussion about animal testing and what we can do to improve the lives of animals.
And how have you felt about the media response in general? Like, I found that it seems as though you've got a fair chance to share your perspective, and that they weren't totally slanted, sensationalist reports. How did you feel about the coverage?
The coverage has been really interesting, and you know, I feel grateful for any opportunity I have to speak about animals in the public realm. I think some of the coverage was unfair, just that I was not live and able to respond to some of the people who had negative criticisms, because this book is very well thought out and a lot of research went into it, and I have answers to everybody's questions. So on that front, it's been a little frustrating, but I'm thrilled that there's a discussion nationally and internationally about the subject. And I think, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't even know the word vegan. I don't think it was in my vocabulary at all. And the fact that people know enough about it to argue, at least, is, I think, a step in the right direction. We'll see where we are 10 years from now, when even more people understand the benefits of veganism.
And all our vegan kids have grown up and taken over.
Yeah. I mean, the number of vegans has doubled in the U.S. since 2008. So this is a growing, amazing population of people who are discovering what's going on and learning how to heal themselves and make a positive and instant impact, the most far-reaching impact I believe that any single person can have on every major industry in every corner of the world.
Yeah, that it's incredible and powerful and really exciting to be a part of this. Krista, you are a parent of two older children, as older vegan children, as I said. Do you think you might have utilized a book like this when they were little?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was always struggling for ways to talk about it that was age appropriate, because there wasn't a lot of material out there in that regard. I mean, we've longtime vegetarians and vegans, I'm sure, have all seen the gory movies that you can access on the internet, and those definitely weren't something I wanted to show my kids. And they were already vegan. But having a way for them to access that information and maybe share it with their friends would have been very handy. And I think still I'm considering purchasing a couple of copies of the book to donate to our local libraries.
Good. Yeah. That's a great idea.
Thank you. That's great for anybody who doesn't want to commit to the book but wants to see what's inside of it.
Exactly.
You know, libraries had a huge influence on me in my youth.
Mm-hmm, me too.
You know, we've all had a chance to read through the book, and I was reading through it last night, and as I was saying before the show, I was flipping through the pages and going, okay, so where does the bad part come? Where's the controversial part? And then the book was over. I'm like, what? Did I miss something? And you illustrated you did all the illustrations as well, and they're all beautiful, by the way, and it's the pictures that the kids are looking at too, right? And I'm like, what's the problem?
Well, I think what people are leaving out of the discussion in the media is that on every single page there's a positive affirmation about action we can take. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really the key when we're talking to kids about important and difficult issues, that the most important lesson is that we don't have to fear anything that we have the power to change.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I'm wondering, like, how do you respond to people who express concern that the book is spreading vegan propaganda or that we're indoctrinating our children or something like that? Have you kind of got that message, and how do you respond to that?
Oh, for sure. I've gotten that since my first book came out. And we really need to look at the definition of propaganda, and that's the propagation of a given doctrine systematically. If we look at our own food systems and our government, 75% of government subsidies goes to meat and dairy, while less than 0.5% goes to fruits and vegetables. So when we take that into account, we really need to look at who is doing the brainwashing.
Yeah, definitely.
That's
it's the people with the deepest pockets, and that there's certainly, you know, despite what some people believe, there's no big vegan propaganda machine that's like funding all this. You're not funded by, you know, some huge conglomerate.
This is all grassroots.
No, and it's impossible. I mean, our voice is still on the periphery of society, so it's impossible that we're shoving anything down anybody's throat or enforcing anything. My real goal in this book is just to present choices, and kids can't make choices if they don't know there are any.
Another point that's been brought up is that the book is violent, and I put that in air quotes here, and Krista had brought up before the show, well, what about all the other, like, there's actual real violence that we're propagating to our children, such as video games, and what else was it that you were mentioning, Krista? I mean, you're the parent.
Oh, I mean, yeah. You know, you look at any of those really medieval fairy tales, or...
Oh, the Hunger Games you mentioned,
yep,
which is so big right now.
Which I love. Yeah, I wasn't criticizing it at all, but I'm just saying, as far as violence in children's stories goes, yours was...
Yeah, if you want to talk about violence, look to those other sources of violence in the media, not to Ruby's Veganist Love book, you know?
Absolutely, and I think there's really nothing in my book that a child wouldn't see walking through the deli section of their grocery store or in the myriad shows on TV about hunting and fishing and even cooking. All those cooking shows have raw pieces of meat and flesh. So it's just the context of talking about the truth.
I think the I think the thing that bothers me the most when people say that I have brainwashed my children into being vegan is where do they think that our overall cultural standards for treating animals come from? It's not like we form these ideas about some animals are pets and some animals are food in a vacuum, that those kinds of ideas come to us filtered through, you know, the zeitgeist of our society. So there is no such thing as brainwashing a child. The child is a product of whatever the parents decide to teach it.
You're purposely educating your children, whereas I think perhaps other parents are not even bothering to educate. As you say, their kids are getting their education through the media, not from their parents or from their friends or from all sources around them. You are purposely teaching your children and have taught your children compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you don't intercept the hundreds, if not thousands, of biased messaging that our children are being targeted with every day, someone else is happy to do it. And
that's
people
right.
do believe that their food choices in eating animals is completely neutral. But I think if the public would look at the degree of collusion between our government and the pharmaceutical companies and big agriculture, then the outrage would really be directed at the industries and not at a children's book about choices alternative.
Exactly. And, you know, I was just going to say a lot of the controversy around the book kind of reminds me of the controversy that surrounds things like sex education for kids. Mm-hmm. You can present a very, you know, factual, a really straightforward thing about sex ed, and there's going to be a group of people who are just completely offended and think everything, like teaching children the proper names for their body parts and that sort of thing, is all wrong. And
do they get on Fox News though?
Yeah, sure. I've seen it. There was a story about something
blasphemy when you're on Fox News.
Yeah, but I mean, there's an exhibit going on in Ontario right now of like sex education, and there's been a huge, huge backlash to it. So it's just that kind of thing.
I think with the health crises and the environmental crises and the economic crises that we find ourselves in, it's never too early to begin teaching our kids how our choices affect the public realm. And I think that at the root of all of those crises is a self-involvement, you know, that our education and our technology and our desires are more important than the actual ground we walk upon and the animals and the people across the world that we affect.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it's never too early, and I think everybody can agree that the more you know, knowledge is power. And what can more knowledge hurt us? Why should we be on a layaway plan, you know, for education and knowledge?
That knowledge will empower the kids is what I would think if I had kids. I would definitely want them to be armed with the knowledge of issues having to do with animals and other issues as well. There's, you know, it's all about educating your children as opposed to just being complacent about it and letting, as Krista said, letting everyone else educate your children.
Yeah, and marketing is getting more and more slick. So I think kids need to be more and more prepared of how to navigate this kind of a world.
Certainly, and it seems to me like a lot of children are learning, you know, not necessarily consciously, but parents are teaching their children unconsciously about denial and disconnect. And I mean, sure, maybe the truths in your book are a little bit hurtful, as truths often are. They're a little bit sad, but you know, we don't live in a Disney cartoon, and I think that's a really important lesson for kids to look behind the veil and just say things aren't as they appear.
Otherwise, we're really building a real apathetic society here, which has not, I mean, I think it might be even getting worse from when I was younger. I don't know if you have opinions on that, but I think so, because there's just more media infiltrating our system and our society, and we sort of, people just believe whatever they hear from the big media corporations. So we need books like this. So thank you, Ruby, for writing these two books.
Yeah. And I'm wondering sort of what the fear is. Like, is it that this book will get into the hands of kids who aren't vegan and then they will force it on their parents, or they won't eat, or it will cause them mental problems, or they'll get depressed, or what are...
I think at the root is kind of a practical fear of not being familiar with veganism and having your kid come home and say, I'm not going to eat chicken or animals anymore, and you literally don't know what to make.
Mm-hmm.
So on one hand, I understand it, but at this point in time, there are answers for everybody's questions, and the information we have is absolutely accessible to everybody, you know, at the tip of their fingers.
Maybe we need a companion book for parents to go along with Vegan is Love, so that when the kids want to go vegan, the parents can use your companion book to figure out how to do that.
There's so much out there, you know, though. I feel that veganism has never been more accessible than
it
is today.
The bookshelves are more and more filled with vegan books.
And just, you don't even have to buy a book. You can just go on the internet, and there's literally thousands of blogs and recipe sites and tons of free information out there.
Again,
so
it's about education, though, and
free.
People don't know about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is the key word there.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
There was, I remember a story from maybe a few years ago that probably made national headlines. I don't know really where this story came from, but it was about, I think, a baby died and her parents were vegan,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of blew up, and people just kind of cling to that story.
Forgotten about that story.
But
that's old news.
Not now that Alyssa's brought it up.
Well, but the issue is like any parent can feed their kid a nutritionally deficient diet.
Mm-hmm.
Veganism doesn't really matter. I mean, they happen to be, but I think she was just, you know, feeding them apple juice and like not much else or something.
It was rice milk.
Yeah,
it was
an absolute insane case of parenting that was really about that insanity and not about the veganism.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that could happen,
to use that as an indictment against veganism is just...
The media really clung to that, though, I remember quite clearly.
Of course.
Yeah. Anything sensationalistic like that.
Yeah, and it seems like there's almost sometimes like an implicit sort of judgment that raising vegan children is is close to child abuse or something because it's so deficient.
Well, I think that that's super important because people forget that throughout history and throughout the world, there have been nations of people who have lived on plant-based diets, from the ancient Essenes to many Buddhists and Hindus and Seventh-day Adventists and Rastafari. I mean, the list goes on. So this is not new. It's just new to the mainstream that has been indoctrinated by a certain food pyramid for a long time.
That's it, exactly.
Well, I'm very glad that you're shedding light on the issues, and thank you so much for your book and for being with us today, Ruby. I hope that it goes, you know, far beyond parents, and as Allison said, or as you said, Krista, we should get it into the libraries, mm-hmm. and
school libraries, yeah. public libraries.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
Thanks for writing this book. In 20 years, people are going to be like, what was the deal with that? There's tons of vegan books out for kids now.
Exactly.
Exactly. Well, thank you guys for giving me the platform and for helping spread the word to everybody.
Great. Thanks, Ruby.
Take care.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices radio show on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. On next week's show, we'll be having an interview with Dr. David Steele. He's a geneticist at the University of British Columbia and president of EarthSafe Canada. He'll be talking to us about everything you always wanted to know about antibiotics in factory farm meat. We'll also have a feature interview with Nick Cooney. He is the author of a book called Change of Heart, What Psychology Can Teach Us About Spreading Social Change. It's a really interesting book that I've been reading that delves into the issues of the mind when animals and social activism is involved. We here at Animal Voices Vancouver modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. You can do so by signing up for our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. Join us at Twitter at Animal Voices YVR, and you can find us on Facebook as well. And I mentioned that already. And RadioAnimalVoices@gmail.com is our email address. We are leaving you with a song by Rafi, fellow Canadian Joshua Giraffe. Stay tuned now for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thanks for listening to the Animal Voices show, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Joshua Giraffe was born in a zoo. He lived there too for 2 years and a half. He hasn't had a bath. My mommy doesn't lick me, even when I'm sticky. From candy floss, candy apples, popcorn, soft drinks, jelly beans, and gumdrops, there must be something better than living in this cage. But I'm really not too sure, 'cause I'm rather short of age. Joshua Giraffe was feeling kinda sad. Things were going bad, how little of life he'd had. Wasting away with no room to play. Trapped in a zoo with buffalo poo. So he went next door to the elephant and he asked him what to do. I'm wasting away with no room to play. I'm trapped in a zoo with buffalo poo. The elephant was very old and gray, and he had a huge balloon bottom. And he said, "Never fear, Joshua, for a vision will appear." That night, a dream came to Joshua. And Joshua saw animals like crazy monkeys. And a whole pile of hippopotamuses. And pretty moths. And frog size 12.
Ribby. Ribby.
Ribby. And sleazy lizards. and a tribe of nasty saviars. But Joshua wasn't afraid, because he sang himself this song.